Chapter 9. One morning, immediately after we had passed the deserted village, we started hearing something like the roar of big engines, the rolling of metal drums on a tar road, a thunder exploding, roll after roll. All these sounds reached our ears simultaneously. We hurriedly deviated from the path, running into the bushes and lying on the ground. We searched one another's faces for an explanation of the strange sound. Even Kenny, who sometimes had answers, couldn't tell us what we were hearing. We all looked at him and his face contorted with confusion. "We have to find out what it is, or we can't continue on to Yile," Kenny whispered, and then began to crawl toward the sound. We followed him, quietly dragging our bodies on rotten leaves. As we got closer, the sound intensified and a heavy breeze shook the trees above us. We could clearly see the blue sky but nothing else. Kenny hesitantly sat on his heels and surveyed the area. "It is just water. Lots of it. And sand. Lots of it." Kenny was still looking. "What is making the noise then?" Alaji asked. "All I am looking at is water and sand," Kenny replied, and then waved to us to come closer and take a look. We sat on our heels for a while, looking in different directions, trying to locate what was making the sound. Without saying anything to us, Kenny crawled out of the bushes and started walking on the sand toward the water. It was the Atlantic Ocean. The sound we had heard were those of the waves hitting the shore. I had seen parts of the ocean but had never stood at the shore of one this vast. It spread out beyond the vision of my eyes. The sky was at its bluest and seemed to curve down and join with the ocean in the distance. My eyes widened, a smile forming on my face. Even in the middle of the madness, there remained that true and natural beauty, and it took my mind away from my current situation as I marveled at this sight. We walked closer and sat at the edge of the sand and stared at the ocean, admiring the display of waves in succession. They came in three folds. The first was small but powerful enough to break a person's leg. The second was high and more powerful than the first, and the third was a spectacle. It rolled and rose higher than the shoreline as it moved forward. We ran away from where we sat. The wave hit the shore so hard that it sent sand particles flying up in the sky. When we went back to look, the waves had thrown out unwanted flotsam from the ocean, including some big crabs that I guess weren't strong enough to cling to the ocean floor, but they were still alive. It was a calm walk along the sand, since we didn't expect trouble in this part of the country. We chased and wrestled each other in the sand, played somersault and running games. We even bundled up Elijah's old shirt and tied a rope around it to make a soccer ball. We then played a game, and each time one of us scored a goal, he would celebrate with a sukus dance. We shouted, laughed, and sang our secondary school songs. We started walking on the sandy beach early in the morning and saw the sunrise. At midday, we saw a cluster of huts ahead and raced each other toward them. When we arrived there, we suddenly became worried. There was no one in the village. Mortars lay in the sand, rice spilling out of them. Jerry cans leaked water, and fires were left unattended under cooking huts. Our first guess was that the rebels might have been there. Before we could think of anything else, fishermen sprang from behind huts with machetes, fishing spears, and nets in their hands. We were so shocked by this sudden uproar that none of us was able to run. Instead, we shouted, "Please, we're harmless and just passing by," in every possible one of the 18 local languages that each of us knew. The fishermen jabbed us with the flat edges of their weapons until we fell on the ground. They sat on top of us, tied our hands, and took us to their chief. The villagers had heard a rumor that some young people believed to be rebels were heading their way. Upon hearing this, they had armed themselves and hid, waiting to defend their homes and protect their families. This should not have been a big shock to us, but we didn't expect it to happen here, since we thought we were now far from home. They asked us several questions along the lines of where we were from, where we were going, and why did we choose that direction. Alhaji, the tallest among us, and sometimes mistaken for the oldest, tried to explain to the chief that we were just passing by. Afterward, the men yanked our torn crepes off our feet, untied us, and chased us out of their village, waving their spears and machetes and screaming after us. We didn't realize what sort of punishment the fishermen had given us until we stopped running away from their village. The sun was in the middle of the sky, It was over 120 degrees and we were barefoot. The humidity by the sea was less than inland, but since there were no trees to provide shade, the sun penetrated right into the sand, making it hot and loose. Walking barefoot on the sand was like walking on a hot tar road. The only escape from this pain was to keep walking and hope for something miraculous. We couldn't walk in the water or the wet sand near its edge. It was very deep between where we walked and where the water met the land. And the waves were dangerous. After I had cried for several hours, my feet became numb. I continued walking but couldn't feel the soles of my feet. We walked on the hot, burning sand until sunset. I have never longed for a day to conclude as I did that day. I thought the arrival of sunset would heal my pain, but as the heat died down, the anesthesia also wore away. Each time I lifted my feet, the veins in them tightened and I felt the sand particles digging into my bleeding soles. The next several miles were so long that I didn't think I would be able to make it. I perspired and my body shuddered from the pain. Finally, we came upon a hut that was on the sand. None of us was able to talk. We walked inside and sat down on logs around the fireplace. There were tears in my eyes, but I was unable to cry because I was too thirsty to make a sound. I looked around to see the faces of my traveling companions. They were crying as well without a sound. Hesitantly, I looked under my feet. Peeled flesh hung down and congealed blocks of blood and particles of sand clung to each hanging bit of skin. It looked as if someone had literally used a blade to cut the flesh under my feet from the heel to the toes. Discouraged, I looked into the sky, through a tiny hole in the thatch roof, trying not to think about my feet. As we sat in silence, the man whose hut we had occupied came in. He stopped at the door and was about to turn around when he noticed I was suffering. His eyes met our frightened faces. Musa had just lifted his foot and was trying to separate the sand particles from his flesh. The rest of us were holding our knees so that our feet wouldn't touch the ground. The man motioned for Musa to stop what he was about to do. He shook his head and left. A few minutes later, he returned carrying a basket full of some type of grass. He quietly made a fire and heated the grasses and then placed them underneath each of our hanging feet. The steam from the grass rose to our soles and it gradually lessened the pain. The man left without saying anything. Later he returned with fried fish soup, rice, and a bucket of water. He put the food before us and motioned for us to eat. Again he disappeared, returning a few minutes later, this time smiling widely. He had a fishing net on his shoulder and held a pair of oars and a big flashlight. You begin and feel better, right? Without waiting to hear whether we were feeling better or not, he went on to tell us where the sleeping mats were and that he was going fishing and would be back in the morning. He didn't even bother to ask our names. I guess he didn't think it was necessary or important at that moment. Before he left, he gave us ointment to rub on our feet and stressed that we do it before going to sleep. We were very quiet that night. No one said a word. The following morning, our nameless host came again with food and a smile on his face that said he was glad that we were doing fine. We couldn't walk well, so we just hobbled around the hut and made fun of each other to avoid boredom. Kene boasted about being an excellent soccer player. Musa threw him a groundnut shell. Kene moved his foot to kick it, but then realized that it would hurt and abruptly swung his foot back, dragging it against a stone. He began to blow on his sole in pain. What kind of soccer player are you going to be if you're afraid to kick an empty groundnut shell? Musa laughed. We all gradually began to laugh. Musa had a round face and he was short and bulky with tiny round ears that matched his face. His eyes were big and looked as if they wanted to leave his face. Whenever he wanted to convince us of something, they would brighten. Kene had a long and calm face and unlike Musa, he was skinny and had short, really dark hair that he took great care of every morning or whenever we stopped at a river or a stream. He would rub water on his head and take his time to carefully arrange his hair. Are you meeting a girl somewhere? Elijah would ask, giggling. Kene, with his soft yet authoritative voice, always seemed to know what to say and how to handle certain situations better than the rest of us. Whenever Elijah spoke, he used elaborate gestures. It was as if he wanted his already long hands to extend toward whomever he was talking to. He and Juma were friends. They walked next to each other. Juma was always nodding his head, agreeing to whatever the lanky Elijah said to him as we walked. Juma used his head to gesture rather than his hands. Whenever he spoke, he waved his head left to right. He left his hands crossed behind his back most of the time, like an old man. Saido and Moriba were almost as quiet as I. They always sat next to each other, away from the group. Saido breathed hard as we walked. His ears were large, and when he was listening, they stood up like a deer's. Moriba always told him that he must have extra hearing ability. Moriba mostly played with his hands, examining the lines on his palm and rubbing his fingers as he whispered to himself. I barely spoke. I knew Elijah, Kene, and Musa from my former secondary school. We never talked much about our past, especially our families. The few conversations we had that weren't related to our journey were mostly about soccer and school before we resumed our silence. The pains we felt from our feet subsided on the fourth night. We went for a walk around the hut, and during our stroll, I found out that the hut was only about half a mile from the main village. At night, we could see smoke rising from the tiny village's cooking huts. We stayed in the hut for a week. Our host brought us water and food every morning and night. He had the whitest teeth that I had ever seen, and he was shirtless all the time. Sometimes when he came to check on us in the morning, he had chewing sap in his mouth. I asked him one morning for his name. He laughed softly. "It is not necessary. This way we will all be safe." The following night, our host decided to take us to a part of the Atlantic Ocean that was nearby. As we walked, he engaged us in conversation. We learned that he was Shabro, one of the many tribes in Sierra Leone. When he heard the stories of how we had walked from Matrujong, he couldn't believe us. He said he had heard about the war, but still had difficulty believing that people could do the things that he had heard they did. Our host had been born in the main village and never left. Traders came to his village with clothing items, rice, and other cooking ingredients to exchange for salt and fish, so he didn't need to go anywhere. If I had to guess, I would say he was in his early 20s. He said he was going to get married the next month and was looking forward to it. I asked why his hut was removed from the village. He explained that it was his fishing hut, where he kept his nets and other fishing items, and where he dried fish during the rainy season. When we got to the ocean, we walked to an inlet where the sea wasn't rough. We sat on the banks. "Put your foot na di wata, make the salt water sukam." He also said that the salt water was good for healing the pain and preventing tetanus. Our host sat aside, looking at us, and each time I looked at him, he was smiling and his white teeth stood out against his dark face. The dry breeze from inland coupled with the cool ocean air was perfectly soothing. I wanted to know his name so badly, but I restrained myself. "You boys must come here every night to put your feet in the ocean. This way you'll be healed in less than a week," he said. He looked in the sky, where the stars were beginning to be covered by fast-moving clouds. "I have to go take care of my canoe. It will rain soon, so you must go back to the hut." He started running in the sand toward the main village. "I wish I could be that man. He's just so happy and content with his life," Elijah said. "He's a very nice man too. I really want to know his name," Kene said softly. "Yes, yes." We all agreed with Kene and went wandering into our own thoughts, which were interrupted by a sudden burst of rain. We hadn't listened to our host and left when he had told us to. We hastened to the hut. There, we sat around the fire to dry ourselves and eat dried fish. We had been with our host for 2 weeks and were feeling better when very early one morning, an older woman came to the hut. She woke us and told us to leave immediately. She said she was the mother of our host and that the people in the village had found out about us and were on their way to capture us. From the way she spoke, I could tell that she had known about us all along. She brought with her dried fish and fresh water for us to take on our journey. We didn't have enough time to thank her and tell her to thank her son for his hospitality. But from what she said, it was clear that she knew we were thankful and she cared about our safety more than anything else. "My children, you must hurry now, and my blessings are with you." Her voice was trembling with sadness, and she wiped her disconsolate face as she disappeared behind the hut and headed back to the main village. We were not fast enough to escape the men who came for us. 12 of them ran after the 7 of us, wrestling us to the sand. They tied our hands. In truth, realizing I would eventually be caught, I had stopped running and offered my hands to be tied. The man chasing me was a little taken aback. He approached me with caution and motioned another man walking behind me with a stick and a machete to pay attention. As the man tied my hands, we exchanged a glance that lasted a few seconds. I opened my eyes wide, trying to tell him that I was just a 12-year-old boy. But something in his eyes told me that he didn't care for my safety, but only for his and his village's. The men walked us to their village and made us sit outside in the sand in front of their chief. I had been through this before and wondered if it was a new experience for my present traveling companions. They were all heaving as they tried to hold back their cries. I began to worry because last time I had found someone in the village who had gone to school with us and saved us. This time we were a long way from Matrujong, a long way gone. Most of the men were shirtless, but the chief was elegantly dressed. He wore traditional cotton clothes with intricate design on the collar made of yellow and brown thread, zigzag vertically across his chest. His brown leather sandals looked new, and he carried a staff with carvings of birds, canoes, all sorts of animals, and a lion's head on the handle. The chief examined us for a while, and when he caught my eye, I gave him half a smile, which he dismissed by spitting on the ground from the kola nut he chewed. His voice was hoarse. "You children have become little devils, but you came to the wrong village." He used his staff to gesture instead of his hands. "Well, this is the end of the road for devils like you. Out there in the ocean, even you rascals cannot survive." "Undress them," he commanded the men who had caught us. I was trembling with fear but unable to cry. Alhaji, who stammered with terror, tried to say something, but the chief kicked the side of the stool that he sat on and proclaimed, "I do not want to hear any word from a devil." Our nameless host and his mother stood in the crowd. His mother squeezed his hand each time the chief called us devils or screamed at us. As I was being undressed, the rap cassettes fell out of my pockets, and the man who undressed me picked them up and handed them to the chief. The chief looked closely at the faces on the covers of the cassette cases. He carefully examined the Naughty by Nature cassette cover over and over, looking at the militant stance and tough expressions on the faces of the three guys standing on broken rocks with a lamppost in the background, puzzled by their poses. He demanded that a cassette player be brought. One of the men told the chief that the only way we could possess such foreign cassettes was either by having looted them or if we were mercenaries. The chief may have bought the man's first point, but he disregarded his second point, as it was utterly stupid. "These boys are no mercenaries. Look at them." The chief went back to inspecting the cassettes. I was a little glad that he had called us boys and refrained from the word devil, but I was extremely uncomfortable sitting naked in the sand. It was not a pleasant experience. Just the thought of what was happening was enough to get me agitated. I fought hard mentally to let my face show the opposite of what I felt. The flesh on my face twitched as we waited for the chief to grant us life or death. When the cassette player was brought, the chief put the cassette in and pressed play. "OPP, how can I explain it? I take you frame by frame it, to have you all jump in shall we singing it. O is for order, P is for people scratching tempo." Everyone listened attentively, raising their eyebrows and cocking their heads as they tried to understand what kind of music this was. The chief abruptly stopped the song. Some of the villagers leaned against their round mud huts, and others sat on the ground or on mortars. The men rolled the legs of their taffeta pants. Women adjusted their wrappers, and children stared at us, their hands inside their pockets or in their runny noses. "Stand them up and bring him here," the chief commanded. When I was brought closer, he asked me where I had gotten this type of music and what was the point of having it. I explained to him that it was called rap music and that myself, my brother, and my friends, not the ones I was with, used to listen to it and perform the songs at talent shows. I could tell that he found this interesting as his face was beginning to relax. He asked the men to untie me and give me my pants. "Now you show me how you, your brother, and friends did it," the chief said. I rewound the tape, mime and dance to OPP, barefoot in the sand. I didn't enjoy it, and for the first time I found myself thinking about the words of the song, closely listening to the subtle instruments in the beat. I had never done such a thing before because I knew the words by heart and felt the beat. I didn't feel it this time. As I hopped up and down, hunched and raising my arms and feet to the music, I thought about being thrown in the ocean, about how difficult it would be to know that death was inevitable. The wrinkles on the chief's forehead began to ease. He still didn't smile, but he gave a sigh that said, "I was just a child." At the end of the song, he rubbed his beard and said that he was impressed with my dancing and found the singing interesting. He asked for the next cassette to be played. It was LL Cool J. I mimed the song, "I Need Love." When I'm alone in my room, sometimes I stare at the wall, and in the back of my mind, I hear my conscience call. The chief turned his head from side to side as if trying to understand what I was saying. I watched him to see if his face was going to change for the worse, but a look of amusement flickered on his face. He ordered that all my friends be untied and given back their clothes. The chief explained to everyone that there had been a misunderstanding and that we were only children looking for safety. He wanted to know if we had stayed in the hut of our own accord or if the owner knew about us. I told him that we had stayed there on our own and that we hadn't come in contact with anyone until that morning. The chief told us that he was letting us go, but that we had to leave the area immediately. He gave me back my cassettes, and we were on our way. As we walked, we examined the rope marks on our wrist and laughed about what had happened to avoid crying.